This Weekend starts right after this.
Do you own or rent your home? Sure you do. Fortunately, Geico makes it easy to bundle your home and car insurance. It's a good thing, too, because having a home is hard work. Go to geico.com, get a quote, and see how much you could save. Geico.com. Easy.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This Weekend with your host, Gordon Deal.
Exhaustion at work. I'm Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
Burnout at the office remains a concern as we head into another year of the pandemic. Hear why employees are still suffering.
Car makers are promising self-driving vehicles within a few years. We'll have a reality check.
Besides heated benches, how football players can stay warm in the extreme cold this weekend.
And Jeopardy may be without a permanent host, but the TV game show is having a terrific season.
We're seeing these winning streaks happening on the show, most recently with Amy Schneider's win. She's closing in on the top two winners of all time in their contestants in terms of their winning streaks. So that's really been kind of exciting for a lot of viewers. Also, you know, we have these two hosts, Ken Jennings and Mayim Bialik, who have kind of settled into a rhythm.
John Jurgensen at the Wall Street Journal on what is Jeopardy doing just fine without a permanent host. Well, here we are, heading into year three of the pandemic, with work burnout still sky high, despite companies' efforts to prioritize employee mental health. Why are so many workers still suffering from exhaustion at work? Analysis from Shasheen Shah, CEO of Coherent Strategies Consulting and Coaching. Shasheen, what are you seeing?
Well, I mean, here's the deal. I think COVID, what I've seen, at least on the front lines, is people, if you've had a crack in your windshield, you know, on the passenger side, and you haven't been paying attention to it, and you'll deal with it at some point, guess what? That thing shattered across your entire face, and you're getting forced to take a look at your life. You're getting forced to take a look at your boss. You're getting forced to take a look at your coworkers. You're getting forced to take a look at your career, your choices, your education, your life, your lifestyle, your personal habits, your relationships at home. All of that stuff is coming up for people. So they're calling it burnout. I think it's just called, like, if anything's out of alignment, it's time to do an alignment check. And that's what's going on, I think.
Okay. But many of us are working from home. So why is it stressful working from home?
Well, just think about it. I mean, come on, it doesn't take that much. I mean, you don't need a specialist to figure that one out. I mean, a lot of people's home environments aren't particularly great. You're suddenly stuck there with the kids. And if you've gone to the office where, let's just say you're a manager, where you're getting the respect and the love from, you know, your coworkers, and you're the big manager, and then you go home and you've got a honey-do list to do, you got kids needing you and wanting you, it's a tough duty to come back home, and it's a shock for a lot of people.
You brought up something in your notes here that talked about the root cause of excessive stress. Maybe it's not necessarily the pandemic, but that's the straw that broke the camel's back.
I think so. I mean, look, in my work that I deal with, I work with really highly successful people. These guys are, you know, they're amazing people that can run up the ladder, ring the bell time and time again. And, you know, when we start, you know, looking at, you know, what's it take to get to the next level, the first place we got to look is internally. And so it really is, and especially New Year's. I just did a show on, you know, New Year's resolutions. And I just said, look, at the end of the day, forget about the New Year's resolutions. Look back, see where you are, do an alignment check, check out, you know, your home environment, your work environment, the nature of your relationships. Where are you holding on to love or withholding love? Where are you holding on to resentments? Where do you find yourself being righteous? Look at your habits, behaviors. You know yourself better than anyone else. And so if something feels like uncomfortable right now, you got to go deep. You got to go in with yourself, and you got to start doing it. It sounds like, you know, kumbaya, but honestly, that's the only place to really look is internally.
We're speaking with Shasheen Shah, executive consultant, also author of a book called The Kid and the King. And we're talking about employees still suffering from work exhaustion. So let's say we've identified a handful of things that are really bugging us or stressing us out. How do we hash it out?
I mean, you got to be willing to tell the truth, right? Number one. And then you got to start taking baby steps. And I'm telling you, in theory, it sounds super easy, but in practice, it's really hard. And I think what the good news is for me and a lot of this stuff is people have hit the wall and they're tired. They're like, I have been putting up with this for so many years, and they're being forced to look at it. So it's shaking the tree pretty big right now. And I think that, you know, just find, you know, people are like trying to make these big changes in life. Just go for the first lever you can pull in your life, whatever that might be. If you're drinking every single night of the week, maybe drink six nights of the day of the week. If you've been, you know, eating a lot of junk food, do that one day less. If you haven't been working out, try one day a week, whatever it is. But just start making little baby steps and get the leverage you need to, you know, make that change. You know, the joke I always tell my clients, especially when they're in coaching with me, is, you know, the New Year's card says, you know, wishing you the most epic breakdown this year such that you find the leverage you need to make the changes you have to in order to live the life you've been destined to live. And that's all I got to say about that.
Wow. Do you get the sense now as we enter year three?
Yeah.
That we're better managers of all this, or there's still enough of us who are struggling to figure it out?
I think it just depends on who you are. I mean, I think there's a camp of people who have taken it and like have run with it and then made some extraordinary change in their lives. I know for me, that was true. I mean, I could have gone down the dark road and I said, you know what? I know what that looks like. And I didn't do that. There are others that I've met and I've talked to that have just put on, you know, 15, 20 pounds. They've been drinking a bunch. Man. They've been kind of lost in their own little exploration. And I think it's just brought to surface what needs to be brought to surface. And so if you're in the camp that's been struggling, take the opportunity to lever up and make the changes you need. And if you haven't, and if you started to make those changes, keep exploring and leaning into the discomfort, man. Pick up. What would it look like? What's the worst case scenario if you're packing it all up and trying something new?
That's Shasheen Shah, CEO of Coherent Strategies Consulting and Coaching. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. As the saying goes, never let a crisis go to waste. And with COVID, a growing body of researchers and public health experts are taking that advice literally. Scientists are increasingly using raw sewage as a tool to help determine how infections are trending. It's a story by Kyle Bagenstos, environmental reporter at USA Today. Kyle, how's it work?
According to the scientists that I talked to, basically you have the sewage treatment plant, like every community in the country has one, you know, and they have their partners, their operators of these plants, they basically every day or a couple times a week, collect a little sample of sewage, bottle it up, mail it to a laboratory somewhere, oftentimes overnight, to try and, you know, get the most recent data they can. Scientists take these samples, they run it through the same kind of equipment, the PCR equipment that people are familiar with, a traditional COVID test, and they measure COVID levels in sewage to try and determine what's going on in that population in terms of which way things are trending.
Wow. All right. So what have we learned, say, in various parts of the country at this point?
Yeah. So they've been doing this kind of testing since the start of the pandemic in different places. It's kind of grown in popularity. A lot of cities work with their local academic institutions, but you also see commercial entities really picking up. There's a firm called BioBot Analytics that has over 200 treatment plants across the country that it analyzes. And now they have a pretty robust data set. And the news was that in Boston, which is one of the first places that saw an Omicron spike, scientists saw the first little downtick in terms of the amount of COVID in that city. And it was the first kind of sign that maybe there's a light at the end of the tunnel for Omicron. And actually, in just the past couple of days, they're starting to see this little trend in other communities across the country. So, suggesting momentum that maybe we're starting to, or I've reached the peak and maybe are starting to do the decline of the Omicron wave.
Wow. All right. So you referenced this downtick. Is that, I mean, without getting too much in the weeds here, is that the concentration of the virus is down in the sample? Like, you know, the pink line isn't as bright, you know, for lack of a better analogy?
Yeah, I mean, the way that I understand it is, you know, people might be familiar with the term, viral load or viral shedding. When you're symptomatic and can spread COVID, you know, you're breathing it out there, it's going out the thing. Well, the same stuff. Material ends up in your feces, which ends up at the sewage treatment plant. So they can kind of measure, you know, generally, is the amount trending up or is it trending down? So that's how it works.
Well, we're speaking with Kyle Bagenstos, environmental reporter at USA Today. His story is called When Will This COVID Surge End? Scientists Search Your Sewage for Clues. And who knew, by the way, other than by reading your story, that there was such thing as a sewer coronavirus alert network?
Yeah, that's a group of scientists from across the country. And I think one of the kind of additional leading outfits that are monitoring levels from different cities, and especially in Northern California, to get a pretty good regional look, at least, of how things are trending there.
You said, too, wastewater testing is also providing some advantages as Omicron surges. How so?
Yeah, so, you know, with any time you're doing testing of a person, it relies on a lot of factors. You know, you have to have people actually coming in and getting tests. If you have a home kit, it relies on people, submitting that in. And I think there's some questions about whether Omicron is behaving the same way as past variants in terms of when it shows up on a test as a positive or negative. So there could be a little bit of confusion and play with the numbers there. The beauty of the wastewater test has been told to me is, of course, everybody pees and poops, right? So yeah. It does not rely on individual kind of behavior in terms of testing. They can get it right from the treatment plant. So it's an extra helpful data point to kind of, you know, see which way things are trending, regardless of how the traditional testing is working out.
Given the questions surrounding the at-home rapid tests, has anybody suggested that we just stick with wastewater testing? Is it quick enough and reliable enough?
You know, I kind of examined this. I, for reasons a bit beyond me, I think it seems like this is mainly viewed as a good 1-2 punch, a good thing to kind of help with surveillance. And there are some suggestions that especially as we hopefully, you know, move towards COVID becoming endemic and maybe not as much of a top of mind concern, this could be a useful sentinel to kind of keep running in the background, right? So we don't have to constantly be testing people, having them be showing up. This might be kind of a first line of alert. So I think in the future, we may see this potentially, you know, take some priority as the first method of kind of alerting people.
Thanks, Kyle. Kyle Bagenstos, environmental reporter at USA Today. Coming up next, maybe Jeopardy doesn't need a permanent host. Uncomfortable work attire is a thing of the past. If you're still trapped in suits and ties, make it your New Year's resolution to go casual at work. But don't dress down. Get some casual style that fits anywhere. That's what Cuts Clothing is designed for, to fit you and any occasion perfectly. That's how I feel about my t-shirts from Cuts. They look and feel great. Buttery soft. They move with me whenever I'm at the mic or at the gym. And while I could go on about their custom engineered Pika tri-blend fabric, you really have to wear it to understand how soft it is. It's the ultimate blend of high quality cotton, polyester, and spandex. The result is what GQ magazine calls the only shirt worth wearing. And now it's worth even more because it's an even better value. Cuts Clothing is work leisure apparel for the sport of business. Get 15% off your first order by going to cutsclothing.com/Gordon. That's C-U-T-S, cutsclothing.com/Gordon for 15% off the only shirt worth wearing. cutsclothing.com/Gordon.
Hey, glad you're with us. Well, 2021 wasn't the most memorable one for the TV game show Jeopardy, since it didn't have a permanent host. And even though there's still no permanent host, it's on a hot streak in its 38th season. Here's this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka.
Jeopardy was a bit of a disaster last year when its host search turned into somewhat of a sideshow. But now the quiz show is on a hot streak. Here with the story, John Jorgensen of the Wall Street Journal. John, what's fueling the show's popularity?
There's a lot of things happening on Jeopardy that are helping the show rebound from what was really kind of a horrible summer last year. So the biggest thing actually is the gameplay. I mean, we're seeing these winning streaks happening on the show, most recently with Amy Schneider's win. She's closing in on the top two winners of all time in their contestant in terms of their winning streaks. So that's really been kind of exciting for a lot of viewers. Also, you know, we have these two hosts, Ken Jennings and Mayim Bialik, who have kind of settled into a rhythm, at least a familiar rhythm for viewers after the whole kind of host carousel of last year. And lastly, behind the scenes, we have a producer who is really kind of amping up the drama and the competition on the show by kind of treating it as more like a pro sport in the way that they present it on the air.
John, why do audiences like repeat winners so much?
I mean, it's just like any kind of other sports story, right? It's a narrative. There's some drama happening. There's some suspense. You know, is Amy Schneider going to continue into the 40s in terms of her wins? So it definitely builds momentum and builds a story around the show that people feel like they want to tune in for. You know, you don't want to necessarily miss the show where she finally gets defeated. So, I mean, I know some viewers find these kind of boring because it's, you know, they often dominate against other players, but I think for a lot more of viewers, it adds a lot of kind of just excitement and tension around the show. And we see that in some of the ratings. I mean, the show is kicking butt in ratings for this year.
I was going to say, is it all ratings driven, or does the show also like the buzz that surrounds the show and people, you know, tweeting about it and things like that?
Yeah, I mean, they are really kind of capitalizing on that, and everything that happens currently on the show helps distract people from the memory of that terrible host drama of last season. So it's all these factors kind of combining, and people talking about the show, the show itself kind of building suspense in terms of the way it positions it on the air and online, and all that's kind of really adding up to some higher ratings, almost, you know, that we've seen in years for the show.
We're speaking with John Jurgensen of the Wall Street Journal. John, you mentioned the new producer who's making it more like a sports arena. What changes has he made that are getting people interested in it?
I mean, I think you might not necessarily notice it if you're a kind of a casual fan of the show, but Michael Davies is the executive producer we're talking about. And he, you know, he's a savvy game show producer. He's very experienced. He also knows pop culture really well. And what he's doing is kind of super serving the hardcore fans. And to do that, he's really kind of amped up the use of stats and gameplay analytics. They're sharing data about how many times or how good the contestants are about buzzing in on their hand buzzer, stuff that's never been really revealed before. Some of that's being done online, but what they really realize is that, you know, the fans of the show are really hardcore and they're really invested in it, and they want to know all the nitty-gritty details about how it's played. And so by really kind of serving these fans the most, they're kind of drilling down to the essence of the show, which is the game itself. And that's really kind of building all the excitement around it. You know, you get the hardcore fans excited and the rest of the casual fans will follow along.
Have the questions or categories changed over the years? Have there been big things that have, you know, separated what's going on now from the past, or has it really carried through all the years?
I think it's carried through. I mean, the game is still its game. There's, you know, 60 questions in the form of answers, and then one final. It's always the same in its essence, but I think a lot of the people who really watch the show closely, they watch the categories and the writing of the answers about the clues. And I think some people think it's gotten easier. They may complain that way, but it's really hard to kind of pick out a specific pattern that way. I mean, there are kind of trends in the way they do the categories. And there's also trends in the way people play the games. So certainly it has changed a little bit over the years, but it's hard to kind of pin down one reason why maybe more streaks are occurring. There's lots of different factors that seem to be going into that.
That's this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka with Wall Street Journal reporter John Jurgensen. Thanks for being with us. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koshenka. Coming up this half hour, beware the hype for self-driving cars. Also, meeting today's retirees. Plus, getting a household repair professional to your home in a reasonable amount of time. And how NFL players stay warm during extreme cold this time of year in the playoffs. We'll have that story in about 20 minutes. Well, some car makers and tech companies say they're preparing to deliver self-driving cars to consumers within just a few years, a fresh promise that makes it seem like 2016 again. But Joanne Muller, transportation correspondent at Axios, says, beware the hype. Joanne, explain.
Well, it's nothing is easy, right? So we've heard a lot about robo-taxis and self-driving trucks. These are going to be offered autonomy as a service, as a commercial service, and they could happen, you know, this year, next year, very soon, within 2 years. Very limited uses. What's interesting now is that we're hearing some renewed hype about the personal self-driving car. And a couple of companies at CES said they're working on this for the middle of the decade. And my reminder to readers is don't get too worked up over this. It's going to be very limited, both by weather and driving conditions, mm-hmm. but also geographically. It's going to be on limited roads.
Okay, meaning what? Mostly highways? So Friday night, I want the extra drink at dinner. It's not really meant to take me to the restaurant and back?
Right. You better be careful. I mean, right now you cannot do that because you always have to pay attention and keep your hands on the wheel on assisted driving systems. What we're talking about is what comes after that. And these would be places where you could actually check out mentally, maybe do some work, make a phone call, check your email. But envision it for people who are in long commutes and moving relatively slowly and can't stand that drive. Now this would free them up to do things, while they're sitting in the car.
Mm. We're speaking with Joanne Muller, transportation correspondent at Axios, also co-author of a newsletter called What's Next. And her story is called A New Reality Check on Self-Driving Cars. You know, something that stood out to me in your piece, it was a bullet point where you wrote, Volvo and not the human driver will be responsible for the safe operation of the vehicle when their system is engaged. And I was wondering, what does that mean for insurance? Like, if there's an accident, is Volvo covering that?
Absolutely. That's what it means. And Volvo has been one of the few companies to come out and say that. It's a very important question. And Volvo says we got it covered.
Wow. So who are the other companies chatting about this now? Right, GM is involved. The Chinese company Geely, right?
Correct. Yeah. GM, has been working on robo-taxis through their subsidiary called Cruise out in San Francisco. And they've also been working, they have a very good assisted driving system. What they're talking about is sort of merging some of those efforts, leveraging each of them, and coming up with an autonomous vehicle for personal use. They haven't said exactly what that is, but I think the way that Volvo is doing it is really going to be the way that most companies do it. And that is highway driving, good weather, limited roads, just helping you through that awful commute. That's the next step.
And these are not going to be throw-ins, right? I mean, you're going to pay a premium for this probably.
Well, if you think about the fact that Tesla right now is charging $12,000 for what it calls full self-driving, which is not full self-driving, by the way, but it's you're paying for that feature to be turned on in the future. People already forking over $12,000. You can imagine people are going to pay quite a bit for this service, but I think it will be sold as a subscription.
Thanks, Joanne. Joanne Muller, transportation correspondent at Axios. Coming up next, introducing today's newest retirees. Do you own or rent your home? Sure you do. Fortunately, GEICO makes it easy to bundle your home and car insurance. It's a good thing, too, because having a home is hard work. Go to geico.com, get a quote, and see how much you could save. Geico.com. Easy. Glad you could spend part of your weekend with us. COVID-19 completely upended the workplace for many U.S. employees, but new data show that it was largely older women who took the opportunity to escape by retiring during the pandemic. Insight from Megan Lenhart, writer at Fortune. Megan, what are we learning?
So it's interesting, during the course of the pandemic, right, we've heard a lot about folks retiring, potentially even retiring early, and that is true, but the St. Louis Fed actually dug into those numbers a little bit more, particularly around the baby boomers who are retiring, and tried to figure out who actually were those baby boomers that did retire. And so what they found was that it actually turns out the biggest segment of folks who did retire during the pandemic were between the ages of 65 and 74, and they were actually women, usually who were married or widowed and had some kind of some financial support from their partner.
Man, I mean, the number is staggering. 11 times as likely as similarly situated men to retire. Why?
I think it comes down to a couple of factors here, and this was something that William Rogers, who is the St. Louis Fed's Institute for Economic Equality's VP and also the co-author of the report, he was sitting there and telling me that it comes down to the fact that a lot of these women, again, did have financial support, but women are also working in industries that were hard hit by the pandemic and may have had to make some health concern issues here. And then, too, you do have a lot of these folks who are mothers, grandmothers, and they may have been actually asked to step in to help with childcare support.
Mm, right. It was fascinating because, as you point out in the story, all of this, these women retiring from ages 65 to 74 now, this runs contrary to these earlier analyses we heard that argued the pandemic worker shortage was fueled by early retirement. So not so, I guess?
I think it's a complicated picture. We sit there and talk about who's retiring, and of course this worker shortage continues to beg the question of who are these missing workers. And so, yes, when it comes down to it, these women were part of the folks who were retiring. But I do think retirement in today's vernacular is a bit more of a flexible situation than we traditionally think of it. A lot of folks retire, but they don't actually leave the workforce completely, and certainly not right away. And so what ends up happening is a lot of times you'll retire and you'll go on to have a second career. Maybe you'll go part-time. Maybe you'll do something where money isn't necessarily the driving factor of why you're picking up that job or that volunteer opportunity, whatever. So we have that kind of situation playing out, especially because people are living longer. So 65 is no longer, you know, 5 years from the end of your life like it was, you know, many, many decades ago. So you have a long time horizon where most people are like, well, you know, I'm not old and decrepit and going to just like, you know, sit on my rocking chair on the porch here. I want to still be active. And so they end up being involved in the workforce. During the pandemic, however, we did see that a number of folks who did retire did kind of stay on the sidelines because, again, health concerns, I'm sure, played into it. But that's been changing as the vaccines were rolling out. And of course, in the November and December employment reports, we have actually seen a resurgence of these folks coming back. So I don't think that that's a permanent state of being right now. We are going to see retirees coming back, working part-time, doing those jobs that, you know, need to be done, but also doing them on their own time frame.
Thanks, Megan. Megan Lenhart, writer at Fortune. Hey, glad you're with us. As you may have experienced, it's virtually impossible at the moment to hire anyone to do any repair, maintenance, or construction work on your home, no matter how badly you need it. Right now, repair people are like the hottest kids in high school, attractive and skilled at everything, yet unattainable. Funny tips on how to get on their schedule from Chris Frieswick, humor columnist at the Wall Street Journal. Chris, your take.
Well, basically, the column was designed to compare the tactics that one might use to attract the high school hottie to the tactics that one might use to attract the equally in-demand and hot repair person of your choice.
Right.
It is extremely difficult to get any of these people to return your call, let alone to show up. They're super busy right now. The pandemic has made sure that everyone is more than well aware of all of the defects in their homes, and because we are spending so much time in them. And so, you know, construction and home remodeling and interior designers and anything to do with anything in your house, if there is a profession that deals with it, they are busier than they have ever been ever. And so I just thought it might be fun to, you know, go into the Wayback Machine and take a look at, like, how did you actually, like, insinuate your way into the life of that, like, prom king or prom queen that you were oogling as they strolled down the hallway past your locker and you looked on sort of like, why can't they look at me? And so I just sort of translated it into modern day with, I hope, some actual actionable advice.
Right.
And I think a lot of it's just common sense. You know, if you're nice to people, if you treat them with respect, if you treat them like the professionals they are, you know, you're more than likely to get a positive result. Like my mom used to say, more flies with honey than vinegar.
How about on the bribery front?
Yeah, bribery's good. Bribery's a good way to get really anything in life. I mean, parents use it with their children. Politicians use it with their, you know, donor, or donors use it with politicians. Yeah. And you should use it with your home repair people as well. You know, find out what they want. Everybody wants something. And, you know, if they're a true professional, they probably want a great review, or they want to, you know, maybe they have kids who are the same age as yours, and you can take those children on an awesome play date and impress your repair person with how magnanimous and generous you are. And eventually word will get back to the repair person in question. Your name will be remembered with the bribery, I think,
right,
as long as it's legal.
Love it. We're speaking with Chris Frieswick, columnist at the Wall Street Journal, also deputy section editor for the Mansion section of the journal. Her piece is called Household Repair Professionals Are Hot and in Demand. Here's How to Win Their Heart. I love the part where you're talking about, you know, there's a little bit of a song and dance here. And oh, by the way, it might take at least a month because you can't just jump in and say, hey, now that we're friends, come fix my fridge.
Right. I mean, you would never just call up the high school hottie and be like, I want you now. Like, You just that's like career, that's like high school suicide, right? And you can't do that with the repair people either, because they'll be like, I don't know who you are, I'm busy, go away, click. So you kind of have to ease your way in and like create a relationship and become friends, maybe hang out at their favorite watering hole, buy them a couple of brews or glasses of wine, and insinuate your way into their heart.
Cash still works, right? A promise of cash for their services.
Once you have attracted the repair person of your dreams, pay them on the way out the door or very soon thereafter with as close to cash as you can manage, whether that's a check or actual cash money. There's so many of their clients that just aren't paying. You know, they go, they do the work, but then they just never see the money. It's like any small business person, the hardest part of that job is really getting paid. And so if you are identified as a person who pays cash, you're the customer who pays cash on delivery, then you will be remembered fondly.
Thanks, Chris. Chris Frieswick, humor columnist at the Wall Street Journal. Coming up next, football players staying warm during freezing weather. Podcasts have changed the way you get your news, entertainment, politics, everything. They've rewritten the script, literally. Well, there's another exciting development that's rewritten the script too, Masterworks. Masterworks enables you to diversify your portfolio and potentially protect it from market volatility by investing in contemporary art. With Masterworks, they're the fintech startup shaking up the alternative investing landscape, letting you build a portfolio of fine art without spending millions. Basquiat, Picasso, Warhol, invest in paintings by iconic artists like these with Masterworks. Their industry-leading research team has created the first and only platform where anyone can buy and trade shares of paintings, giving you the same access enjoyed by some millionaires and billionaires for generations. And now our listeners get priority access to their latest offerings at masterworks.art/Gordon. Join a new generation of investors at masterworks.art/Gordon. See important disclaimers at masterworks.io/disclaimer. We'll finish with this. When playoff football games are played in extreme weather, the NFL has a message for any complainers. Too bad. So how do players stay warm besides their heated benches and sideline heaters once they have to take the field? USA Today says drinking warm beverages, even hot water, are generally fine for hydration during a game in freezing temps, but do nothing in terms of staying warm or increasing your core body temperature. If players have an extra scuba suit lying around the team facility, they could try that. Scuba wetsuits are generally made of rubber-like material that are unaffected by heat and weathering. Petroleum jelly, like Vaseline, is most effective when the conditions are windy, as it helps insulate exposed skin. It prevents skin from losing heat and moisture. But staying dry is really the key to combating any cold weather situation. And finally, there's a myth about alcohol and it keeping you warm, but it actually increases your risk for cold injuries. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.